Welcome to this dietetic discussion with myself, Dr. Anne Holdaway, where I'm joined today by consultant dietitian Kirsten Jackson. As host of the Dietetic Discussion podcast, our aim is to enhance your knowledge and everyday practice through discussions with some of the leading lights on a range of topics relevant to the practice and evolution of nutrition and dietetics. In this third episode of series three, we're focusing on fibre and irritable bowel syndrome. Having previously hosted a podcast with Kirsten Jackson and Tig Bridge on fibre versus laxatives in the management of constipation, I'm delighted to be joined once again by consultant dietitian Kirsten Jackson, who's here to share her wealth of knowledge and expertise on the role of fibre in the management of IBS. As our understanding of the role and function of various fibre types has evolved, so too has the management of functional gut issues, including IBS. For my own practice, and no doubt for many tuning in today, this is not only proving to be a fascinating area of dietetics, but is an area where dietitians are now playing a leading role in the management and delivery of care. Before we begin this week's discussion, I just wanted to express my considerable appreciation to the team at Nutrinovo for supporting what is now the third series of the Dietetic Discussion. Without their support, this podcast simply wouldn't be possible. As a company, Nutrinovo have consistently demonstrated an innovative approach to clinical nutrition. And having worked in the clinical nutrition industry myself, I'm very aware that innovations often emerge from partnerships between clinicians and industry. And hence a discussion held on this very podcast series might be the springboard for generating product innovations along the vein of the liquid fibre supplement, High Fibre, produced by Nutrinovo. So just to tell you a little bit more about today's guest, Kirsten is a consultant IBS dietitian who's been practicing for over 13 years. Sparked by her own personal experience of IBS, Kirsten has since dedicated her dietetic career to helping others with the condition. Kirsten previously worked as a lead dietitian for King's College Hospital in Dubai and is now an official media spokesperson for the BDA and also an expert advisor to the IBS Network and Forbes Health in conjunction with running her own private practice. Some of you may have heard that Kirsten recently launched her book, Take Control of Your IBS, a step-by-step guide that works. And if you haven't purchased this already, I certainly recommend it as a key read for professionals working in the field of IBS, but also for you to recommend to your clients. Well, welcome, Kirsten. It's a privilege to have you here with me today, and many thanks for joining me to explore the role of fibre in IBS.
Thank you so much for having me. I can't wait to chat through this topic.
Yeah. So whilst I have no doubt many of our listeners will be aware of who you are, I think our listeners would be really interested in and inspired to hear about your journey to this point. So I wondered if you could perhaps provide a little insight into what brought you on this path and what sparked your interest in the management of functional gut issues and specifically irritable bowel syndrome.
Yeah, sure. So I qualified as a dietitian, as most of us do. And then I got very lucky in one of my rotations quite early on. I ended up in Sheffield and gastro, which I thought was a normal experience at the time. But I then later realised it's quite a specialist hospital then. So I was exposed to a lot of different gastroenterology sort of scenarios, which probably might have caused my problems in the first place personally, because I found it quite stressful having to learn a lot of different things quite early on in my career, but very interesting. So it sparked this interest out. But at the time, personally, I then went on to get both celiac disease and then also later IBS. So I obviously had that personal kind of insight into the situation and how complicated it is. Then going forward from there, I then just went on to specialise in irritable bowel syndrome and functional digestive disorders. But yes, definitely having that personal insight definitely helps with it.
Yeah, I think that's hugely valuable in clinical practice, isn't it? And translating our knowledge into practical advice for our patients and understanding their worlds through their lens as well. Today, we're focusing our conversation on the use of fibre in the management of irritable bowel syndrome. And I think this is an area that It's not only ever evolving, but it is also prone to myths and misconceptions and misunderstandings. So can we first start by exploring the role of fibre in irritable bowel syndrome and also functional constipation?
Yes, exactly. So with fibre, I keep hearing time and time again from patients, and I'm sure listeners will have heard this as well, that their doctor has told them to avoid fibre or have a low fibre diet, or just be careful of fibre. And this is actually a big myth, because we really need a high fibre diet in irritable bowel syndrome and functional constipation. I've never to this day had a client, touch wood, that has not managed the 30 grams of fibre per day, eventually, once we've resolved their issues, of course, and they've managed that quite easily, and they've actually needed that and maybe a little bit more. So fibre as a whole is very much needed for IBS, for all the symptoms, whether it's we're looking at improving microbiome, constipation, diarrhea. How we navigate that, which I'm sure we'll go on to in a minute, is the complicated part.
And I think certainly across my career, we've seen a huge change in the management of IBS. And like you say, that myth that still seems to persist in practice is this sort of avoid fibre. And I certainly, like you, inherit a lot of patients where they've been told to avoid fibre. And not surprisingly, it's not the best advice for them. And I think that stems from some of the work in the 80s from Professor Worrell's group about, you know, how bran exacerbated patients' IBS symptoms. But clearly, there's been an awful lot happening in this arena since then. So there's lots of different types of fibre, and our knowledge does continue to evolve in this area with the research. So can you explain the different fibre types and the sources and the potential benefit of the different fibre types, including their physiological function, and when you might encourage their inclusion or increased amounts through the diet?
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm going to do this in the context of IBS specifically. So basically, when we look at fibre, there's different functions of fibre and how they react in the gut. So the one that most people would have heard about is solubility. We always are told about fibre either being insoluble or soluble. So insoluble, it means it's going to speed up the passage of food through the stomach. And historically, we've always seen this as anything that's very high in insoluble fibre is good for constipation. I'll explain why this is not always the case. And equally, soluble fiber, which dissolves in water, it forms like a gel in the bowel, and it can be quite good for diarrhea because it's bulking that stool up. So the theory is there. However, we also need to consider something called viscosity, which means in layman's terms how gloopy it gets, and then also fermentability, which means that how much of it is going to be digested by the microbiota and therefore give off excess gas as a side effect, which for people who don't have IBS might be absolutely fine. But when your gut's already very sensitive, this might be an issue. So for example, if we look at something like chia seed, it's very high in insoluble fiber. So you would think, oh, it's really good for constipation, speeding things up. But actually, chia seeds also got a very high viscosity, so it gets very thick and gloopy. So some people can find that their bowels actually slow down. So it wouldn't be something we necessarily would advise for constipation. And if you look at the example you mentioned there, Anne, a minute ago, wheat bran, for example, again, historically, we might have thought that this is really good for constipation. But actually, even though it's very high in insoluble fiber, which is great, this is what we want, it's also highly fermentable. So you might give somebody wheat bran as a supplement and resolve one issue, but then they're going to end up with maybe a lot of pain, a lot of bloating, gas problems. And then equally, something like psyllium husk would be probably a better example, where it's soluble, but it's got a good viscosity, so not too hard, too low, but it's very low in fermentability. So it's going to give somebody a good bulk to their stool, which is good for both constipation and diarrhea. But equally, it's not too bad for the fermentability. So we're not going to solve one issue, create another. Now, the main issue I have as a dietitian trying to separate all these things out, never mind explain it to the patient, is a lot of foods actually contain various different forms of fiber. So to actually, even in practice, be able to give someone a list and say, here's a list of insoluble, low fermenting foods, is probably very difficult. And the examples I've used there are mostly actually supplements. So wheat bran would be a very specific supplement. Psyllium husk is a specific supplement. But when we look at the diet, they tend to contain actually just a mixture. So it's not overly practical. And I probably in practice, when we'll come to this a bit later, I know, we'll probably use more around looking at the overall amount of fiber, and then also looking at the fermentability, which is the FODMAPs as well.
And I think what you're demonstrating there is it's quite a minefield, isn't it, when you start looking at all the fiber types and their properties. And increasingly we hear about the merit of prebiotics, and you see them on prebiotics in supplements that are sold in whole foods and health food shops. But also we naturally get prebiotics in the diet. So can you also describe a little bit about the role of prebiotics and how their intake can be supported in people with IBS?
Yeah, so prebiotics, just to kind of cover what they are, because I think even as dietitians, sometimes there's confusion over prebiotics, probiotics, postbiotics, is all biotics going on, and it's a very nice marketing field, we'll say at the minute. But prebiotics is something that feeds the microbiota, so those living things in the gut. So in theory, and when the science backs this up to a certain extent, the better number of level the higher the levels are of our microbiota and the more diverse they are, the better not just our gut health, but our overall health is as well. So in theory, if we can feed these, fantastic, right? And some of the research backs this up in terms of an overall diet. So we look at Mediterranean diet. We know that this can actually help IBS, looking at getting those 30 to 30 grams of fiber and a lot of fiber sources of prebiotic. Again, it's all backing this up. However, unfortunately for supplement companies, there is a meta-analysis from 2019 by the King's team, which shows actually using a supplement IBS has not improved any of the symptoms. So an actual supplement of prebiotics didn't seem to improve things. In some cases, it made things a little bit worse potentially, and it didn't improve the quality of life. Interestingly, though, some prebiotics have been shown to improve the levels of bifidobacterium in IBS, which we know can be lower than the general public, which in theory is a good thing, because why not improve it? But if it's not giving that patient actually any symptom relief, does it need to be improved? Why are we suggesting this? It's going to be an extra cost to them. So unfortunately, there's just no solid, I don't know, answers around this to say, yes, definitely a prebiotic supplement will help in this area.
And I think when you look at other trials, you know, in inflammatory bowel disease as well, you know, some of those trials have been actually terminated because of tolerance issues on the use of high levels of supplemental prebiotics. So like you say, it tends to be very individual and symptom led, I think, is what's coming across very strongly. Yeah.
Exactly.
So when you're looking at managing fiber intake with people with the varying types of IBS, and that's IBS-C or IBS constipation, IBS-D, which is IBS diarrhea, and IBS mixed, which is IBS-M, you know, what really guides your decision making and the advice you give?
Yeah, so the answer to this might actually surprise you, or it might not do, considering this is a complicated area. But I think historically, as dietitians, we've maybe always changed the fiber management for depending on the symptoms. And I actually approach the fiber management quite similarly, regardless of what symptom that they have. Take quite a simple approach, really. So there's certain things I always do with all of patients I have. I always look to improve their fiber content quite slowly. So ideally they should be having 30 grams per day, but we would increase this slowly at around 5 grams of fiber per week. So somebody might be coming to you and actually they just don't eat any fiber because they're really scared of these foods. And so you need to manage that part of it as well, not just dictating to them about this, but explain the science behind it, increase it slowly so their gut can get used to it. So that doesn't matter what type of IBS they have, that still goes. And then in terms of the type of fiber, I generally don't get that involved with things like the viscosity unless they are having chia seed pudding every day and they're constipated, something quite particular like that. But what I tend to do is use low FODMAP fibers, which are low fermenting fibers, because I find that that's the most simplest way to do this and most people will tolerate that. So as long as it's a low FODMAP source, so it's not going to create more gas, more bloating, it's not going to draw in more water and cause more pain, it's actually going to help them, then that's fine. And that doesn't necessarily mean that you will do the low FODMAP process with every single patient, but you can definitely start with, if you're going to be adding these high fiber foods into their diet, start with the ones that are least likely to actually cause symptoms or actually going to help. And then I just slowly increase it. In terms of supplements, sometimes I'll use something like psyllium husk or the partially hydrolyzed guar gum, which is a little bit more palatable. It's like drinking wallpaper paste. But again, this is good for all types of IBS. It bulks up the stool. So it's good for constipation, it's good for diarrhea. It's not going to send somebody running from one symptom to the other. And again, the mixed type, it's going to just even those stools out. So again, it's not really good for one and not the other. It's good for both of them. Some other things which people do often miss is things like looking to make sure they're drinking enough fluid. So often we'll say increase the fiber, but actually somebody might be not drinking all day at work, drinking their 2 liters of water or whatever their requirements are in the afternoon, evening. And then we're wondering, why are they really constipated? They're having enough fiber now. And actually it's because the fluid has not been sipped through the day with that fiber, because fiber will look for fluid to work with and form that lovely gel in the bowel as well. The other thing that I would really, I think, tell people is that we need to really manage the expectations in people when we're increasing the fiber, because even if we're going for that low FODMAP source or the low fermenting source, what we really need to make sure is that they understand that actually they're going to physically be eating more food, because fiber is very spacious on the plate, and they might feel a little bit more uncomfortable with that. So that doesn't mean that your patient should be in extreme discomfort or pain or anything like that, but they might feel a little bit uncomfortable. And most people, if you tell them this, they're completely on board. It's a normal process, eases, but again, it's just managing that expectation. And then finally, when they get to the other side, when the symptoms have gone, they've improved, etc., and we're maybe then looking to improve the variety in the diet, one of the interesting things I find is that often at that stage, someone who was originally more IBS-C dominant has little to no food intolerances in terms of FODMAPs. And I think what it is when you go back to, if someone's bowel's very constipated, if we're putting fiber in there, which is fermenting away, it's giving off gas, it's causing some pain, etc., that's going to happen much more than when their bowel's open every day and that gas is being released every day. But somebody who's got more IBS-D type symptoms, they are typically the ones that do have more intolerances when it comes to fiber sources. So it'd be about doing that FODMAP process, if they're appropriate, of course, to do that, and then really identifying what they can tolerate. And of course, making sure everybody just ends up on a very varied diet so that their microbiome is really optimized as much as possible. And hopefully with time, that means their gut will become less sensitive. And of course, always remembering that fiber is just one piece of this big IBS puzzle. So we've got to look at, you know, their mental health, their sleep, their movement, other areas of nutrition and lifestyle. And not everybody is, the fiber is going to be the issue. I have clients where you look at the fiber and it's fine, and actually it's other areas, or they having enough fiber, but another area is actually really poor. We need to work on that first. So it's just making sure they know that as well. Yeah, it's just one piece of the IBS puzzle as such.
And I think you've really captured there this very holistic approach, really, that we now require for the management of IBS, and how important a very detailed history is to understand what the triggers were, how their life is run, really, and bringing in elements of that sort of mental health management and sleep, as well as, you know, focus on their diet and the diet quality and the fibre as well. And I think you also touched upon there about how our knowledge of the fermentable carbohydrates and management of, like, the low FODMAP diet in particular has changed over time. I certainly was quite an avid user at first, particularly in my IBS-D patients. And as time has gone on, like you, I think I draw on it if I'm looking to increase fibre. I think I'm not going to encourage them to eat lots of fermentable carbohydrate, but look at foods that are potentially low to moderate in the fermentable carbohydrates to ensure that they can tolerate them well. But like you say, over time, you often find in those patients there aren't any intolerances as such, but it's more about developing the gut microbiome and them getting used to these foods. And it's this stepwise process that you're talking about, and this incremental increase in their fiber intake. So some really practical points there. I just want to come back to the use of fiber supplements, and you've mentioned some of the fiber supplements you use. Do you find in some patients, just because, like you said, they're scared of these foods, they're scared of fiber-containing foods, that you find that supplements can be quite useful to initially demonstrate to them that if they increase their fiber intake by X amount of fiber that they can see in the label on a product, that then they can, you can demonstrate the benefit, and then you encourage them to then utilize foods to replace that supplement over time? So you might use a supplement for a select period of time.
Yeah, absolutely. I think the supplements, I find it's like it speeds things up. And I don't know if that's come from working in private practice, particularly where you feel under pressure because someone's paying a lot of money to get results. With diet, I don't know why this is, but sometimes it can just take a bit longer. Whereas when I put a fiber supplement in right from the start, typically if someone's got constipation or loose stools, I will normally start with a fiber supplement because I think they're fantastic. Then this really improves things quite quickly. And a lot of the fiber supplements, like the psyllium husk, it tastes literally like wallpaper paste. So they're very keen to get the same results without having to drink this bloody drink. So it's a nice way to demonstrate that. And it's quite a safe one because it doesn't send them running to the toilet. It's quite a soft approach. It's not like a stimulant laxative or something like this.
Yeah. And clearly before in our previous podcast, we talked about, fiber versus laxatives and whether it's versus one or the other, but the use of those groups of products, because like you say, using dietary fiber as opposed to a laxative can be much more gentler in its effect in some of these individuals. Just moving on, probiotics. We hear an awful lot about probiotics in the media. That's the live bacteria and another gut health go-to. In whom might you recommend a probiotic, and what might guide your decision on which product you use? For example, the strain, and the types of bacteria in it.
Yes, so I'll be honest, I rarely use probiotics. I feel like there is research behind them. We've got multiple randomized controlled trials. So there's no denial in that. But I have to say, in practice, I just don't see them showing significant change, and especially for the cost for my patients. And these are patients, I'm working in private practice, so they are very much like, tell me whatever I need to take, I will just take it. So it's not a barrier as such. But I just don't, I see maybe some mild changes. That's it. So typically, if I do use them, it definitely wouldn't be a first line thing. I would normally use it for the person who's got what I would call more microbiome issues. So somebody who's got more gas and bloating type issues where we've done everything else and things are not settling down. That's the type of patient I would use it. Or more often that happens is someone comes and they're already on one. And I'll say to them, if they've been on it for at least 4 weeks and actually they're not really seeing any significant changes, then come off it. If they're determined to stay on it, fine. It's really not going to do any harm either. But I just don't see that they make much difference. But the ones that I would, if I use them, I would always look to make sure the strain being used in it has actually been proven in research to help with IBS, because we know they have a strain-specific effect. So one thing, to the point where there are probiotics out there that might be good even for IBS-D and not for IBS-C. It's very specific. So there's other probiotic that looks nice in the marketing, might be great, but if there's no research behind it, you don't know if it's going to be a waste or not. So we need to do strain specific. We need to make sure that that strain's on literally in the format that was shown in the research. I'm starting to see now companies, and the marketing's great. It's like, it sounds like a good idea, but in reality, it doesn't work. These companies are getting multiple different strains that have been shown in research to help with mental health and also skin and IBS and all every condition under the sun, putting them into one capsule and then trying to sell them as a cure-all. And actually, we don't even know how they react together. So it actually changes the product. So it has to be in the exact strain, in the exact amount, in the exact format, very specific that it was shown in the research. So they are available, but as I said, I don't know about you, Anne, if you see this in your practice, but I don't see significant changes.
Yeah, I think in my own practice, I might reach for them when you, through the history, you think there's definitely some disruption in the gut microbiome and their symptoms haven't responded even before you're seeing them to dietary manipulation. And there may have been a gut infection that dates back to a number of years, that you actually think, oh, it might be worth trialing a probiotic. And particularly if their diet's really good to begin with, you think, maybe not want to tamper with the diet, but add a probiotic in. And sometimes I get results. It's like transformational within, 4 weeks. Their symptoms have resolved just with the probiotic, and then you encourage their diet. But like you say, I think it's really important that as dietitians in particular, we understand the different strains and their effects. And that's all out there in the research. I think a lovely review on this area would be really nice, to look at the different strains and their specific actions. And I think what's coming out from this discussion, Kirsten, is that you know, you make it sound so straightforward in terms of the management of IBS, and your knowledge really shines through on the management of IBS and also your knowledge of different fibre types. But I think for dietitians, you know, we won't necessarily get a lot on our undergraduate courses. There is things like the FODMAP course run by King's and by the BDA. But I understand that you've recently launched a dietitian's IBS course, and I wonder if you'd like to finish by telling us a little bit about that.
Yeah, thank you. So yes, it was, I think it came from a place of frustration of the lack of research, and lack of training that we have and that's even available. So for people even wanting to do those postgraduate courses, yes, it's low FODMAP, but it's one piece of the puzzle. And so what I wanted to do was produce a course that was almost like the Bible of IBS for dietitians. And so it's going through all the practicalities, so even things about how to do the low FODMAP diet with clients. It shows you the research around group programs, the difficulties we have with short consultations, so the real practical side, but also the fiber manipulations, what we can say about medications as dietitians with working within our practice, bringing things back in. It touches on eating disorders, mental health, everything you could ever think about. When you're in that clinic, there is a lot expected of us. And so it's really about giving people the toolkit that they need. And I think it's about 9 hours long as well. So it's quite extensive.
Yeah, but it's great to know it's there as a resource. And like you say, supporting all that we might do as dietitians or other practitioners working in the field of IBS. Because it's not always simple. And I think from your book, which I've dipped into, you know, it shares your frustrations on your own personal journey, but also that it is a step-by-step guide. And we don't always get it right in one consultation. You need time with these patients. We need to review them. And we need to argue for that consultation time with patients if we're working, say, in a health service or otherwise in private practice. I think the education and knowledge of your patient is crucial to get them to buy into the dietary changes and adjustments and change in lifestyle that can really make a difference to the management of the IBS. So on that note, Kirsten, I'd really like to thank you wholeheartedly for joining me today. I'm sure our listeners dialing in will have hugely valued your insights. And I do hope that some of our listeners might go on both to read your book and also sign up to your new course as well. So thanks once again, Kirsten.
Thank you so much for having me.
Once again, I'd like to express my considerable gratitude to Kirsten and also to Nutrinovo. If you've got a moment, we'd love you to leave a 5-star review. And if you've enjoyed this episode and would like to hear more, do subscribe to the Dietetic Discussion and follow at Nutrinovo across both Twitter and Instagram. You can also visit the Nutrinovo Resource Centre, nutrinovo.com, where you'll find the podcast series and other educational resources, including webinars and patient support materials. Do also spread the word about the resources by sharing the link with your department and colleagues. A final quick word about our partner Nutrinovo. I'm delighted Nutrinovo have agreed to support this podcast into its third series. Their innovative approach to clinical nutrition makes them a great fit. Finally, thank you for taking the time to listen to the Dietetic Discussion. I look forward to you joining me on another episode with key guests who'll no doubt enlighten us on other hot topics in nutrition.